Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How has Bill Cosby shaped life in America? Comedians from Chris Rock to Jerry Seinfeld cite Cosby as an influence on their stand-up careers, and Cosby's eponymous 1980s sitcom has been credited with creating positive images of African-American families and even with paving the way for a black family in the White House. Cosby's brilliance is not so much in telling jokes, but stories laid out in his unmistakable voice and punctuated by impeccable timing and a remarkably expressive face. As my guest today will tell us, Bill Cosby's family-friendly public image is complicated by his sometimes dramatic personal life and occasionally divisive opinions on race and responsibility. But after half a century in the public eye, Bill Cosby remains a fascinating and largely beloved figure. Mark Whitaker is a former managing editor of CNN and author of the new biography, Cosby, His Life and Times. Mark, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. Good to be here.
What did Bill Cosby mean to you before you got to know him personally?
Well, on a personal level, I'm a fan. It started when I was 9 years old. My mother bought one of his comedy albums called Wonderfulness. And I came from an interracial family. My father was black. My mother was white. They married in the mid-50s. But they divorced when I was 6 years old, and my mother took my brother and me, we were living in Los Angeles, back to the East Coast. And we settled in a small town in Massachusetts where she taught college and where there were no people of color. And so all of a sudden, she brings home this comedy album with this handsome young black man on the cover riding a go-kart and telling these hilarious stories of having his tonsils out, of smearing Jell-O on the kitchen floor to keep the chicken heart monster away. And so, you know, I think it was bringing laughter into my life at a sad time, but also in a way probably that I didn't completely understand at the time, giving me another, you know, black male of my father's age to identify with. So then I find out that he's also starring on I Spy, which was on Wednesday night past my bedtime at 10 o'clock, but I begged my mother to let me stay up and watch. And there he was a very different persona, this sort of cool, laid-back spy with this great kidding relationship with his white partner, Robert Culp. So I thought that was very cool. And then later, 20 years later, the Cosby Show came on the air just at the time when I was getting married and starting a family. And my wife and I loved the show, as did millions of Americans. But it was also sort of a model of the kind of family that we hoped to have. So I had personal reasons for being interested in him. But I was also, as a journalist, interested in other aspects of his career, particularly in the last 10 years since starting with a famous speech that he gave on the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. You alluded to it in the intro, some of the very strong positions he's taken on some behavior in the black community. The controversy that's set off. And I sort of thought, well, you know, where is this coming from? Why is this entertainer who was known for much of his career and actually criticized in some quarters for much of his career for not introducing race and politics into his comedy and into his television work, all of a sudden being so public about these controversial views? And, you know, I also knew enough about his personal life. The fact that far from a kind of Huxtable upbringing, he had grown up in a housing project in Philadelphia and had a lot of personal, you know, joy, but also tragedy in his life. He lost his only son to a really tragic murder in 1997. So I just thought that he was a figure who had been very important, but also who was much more complicated than people knew, and it would be interesting to get to the bottom of him.
Let's listen to just a little bit of that Brown versus Board of Education commemorative speech.
I can't even talk the way these people talk. Why you ain't where you is, go wild west. know who these people are. And I blamed the kid until I heard the mother talk. And then I heard the father talk. This is all in the house. Everybody knows it's important to speak English, except these knuckleheads. You can't land a plane with why you ain't well. You can't be a doctor with that kind of crap coming out of your mouth.
Very impassioned Bill Cosby there in that speech. And many people were shocked by that address and others that he gave around the same time. And the question was, is this the new Bill Cosby or is this the Bill Cosby that we've known all along, absolutely telling it as he sees it?
Well, I tell the story in the book of how that speech came to be. He was supposed to this was a gathering of hundreds of leading figures in the civil rights movement and in the black political world in Washington on the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education to commemorate the heroes of that decision, Thurgood Marshall and the other lawyers who were involved in the case. And Cosby was slated to come on at the end of the evening just to receive an award for his philanthropy, for all the money that he and his wife have given to historically black colleges and universities, and say a few funny things and then get off the stage. But as he was listening to speaker after speaker talk about, in very rosy terms, about all the progress that had been made, he kept thinking about the progress that hadn't been made. And the ways in which, on the one hand, the Brown decision opened the doors of integrated education to black America. And now, 50 years later, there were elements of black America where young blacks thought it was, you know, getting an education was acting white, where they, you know, as he suggested in the speech, didn't have regard for proper English, at least, you know, the kind that they would need to get certain kind of jobs that, you know, were sort of dressing in a way that, you know, wasn't necessarily going to help them in terms of making it in the mainstream. And, you know, he got more and more worked up. And by the time he got up to the stage, he just went off. And he hadn't planned it and he hadn't planned what he was going to say. And the other thing that I think is important to understand when you listen to that speech is he's used to a sort of jazz-like improvisational storytelling and a lot of comic exaggeration. And here was a case where that approach was mixing with all of this anger and fury that he had. And it ended up being actually a very bizarre speech if you follow it closely. I mean, you know, there were certain fundamental themes that were clear. He was talking about the need for better parenting and more respect for education and responsibility in the black community. But he was doing it with all these wild stories and metaphors and so forth. The speech did reflect views not only that he had then, but had had for a very long time. And I trace them back all the way to his early successes and years in the 60s as a stand-up comic, when it was not in his comedy. But if you go back and look at interviews that he gave and things that he talked about privately, he was already developing those views. But I think the other thing that is important, or at least I argue in the book, that you have to take into account in assessing that speech and the aftermath. Well, actually, two things. One is, that he was criticized at the time. Michael Eric Dyson, the black scholar, wrote a whole book taking Cosby to task as an elitist who, because he was so wealthy and successful, was out of touch with blacks in the inner city. The fact is, I argue that, in fact, it quite the opposite. One of the reasons he was so passionate is because he saw in those kids his own life story. He had grown up poor in a housing project in Philadelphia. His father was a drunk who essentially all but abandoned the family, joined the Navy, wasn't around. His mother was very devoted to him and a very, very bright woman who read to him at night, but was working 12 to 15 hours every day just to support the family. And so she wasn't around much either. And Cosby had a very wayward youth, a bright kid, but he flunked the 10th grade twice. He dropped out of high school, joined the Navy, only barely got into Temple with a GED and a combined SAT score of 500 because he was a talented athlete and he talked the track coach into getting him a track scholarship. So, and he really credits, first of all, the discipline he learned in the Army and then the respect for education that had been sort of the seed had been planted by his mother, but it really sprouted when he got to Temple with changing his life. And so when he preaches in that fiery way to young people today, he's essentially talking about his own life story. The other thing I would say about it is, you know, he did, after the speech, as the controversy mounted, he doubled down. I mean, he continued to make very strong statements. He wrote a book, but he also backed it up. He not only talked the talk, he walked the walk. And he started, he had always, as I document in the book, taken time to go into schools and prisons and so forth to talk to young people, to talk to, you know, the disadvantaged. But he, after that speech, started a series of what he called call-outs of going into some of the worst neighborhoods in America, in West Baltimore, in New Haven, in the rural South, to often just dressed in sweatpants and a sweatshirt, to do what he called call-outs, to meet with young people to talk about the importance of raising their children correctly, to talk to young people about staying in school. So say what you will about the tone of his remarks, he definitely backed it up with his action.
The tone, I think, also surprised people who assumed that he was this perpetually avuncular, easygoing guy. In fact, he has a temper.
No, he does. And you know, I talk about that in the book and it sort of comes out. It's not, you know, people ask, is he an angry man? And, you know, I, both in my research and my dealings with him, I did not detect someone who is perpetually angry. But I think he has a hot streak and sometimes even a violent streak. I talk about an episode in college where he was playing football and he was on the bench, but there was a fan who was heckling the Temple Owls in a way that irritated him. And he and one of his teammates got up for the bench and chased the guy out of the stadium and beat him up. There was another episode actually on the set of The Cosby Show in the 80s. He was very friendly with Tony Orlando, the singer, and they had become buddies in Vegas. And he wanted to get a spinoff show for Tony Orlando. And they were shooting what they call a backdoor pilot, an episode at the end of the first season of The Cosby Show, that if it was successful, where Tony Orlando was the guest star, and the idea is that it would sort of set up the premise for a separate show starring Orlando as the head of a local community center in an urban area. And it wasn't really going well, partly because Tony Orlando was nervous. But Cosby was so invested in this that he took it out on a sound guy who was on the set and almost came to blows. And it was only because Felicia Rashad, or then Felicia Ayers-Allen, then boyfriend, Ahmad Rashad, who was also there, restrained him and kept him from punching the man. So there's that, and the famous time he decked Tommy Smothers in the Playboy Mansion.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break here. My guest is Mark Whitaker. His new book is Cosby, His Life and Times. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mark Whitaker, former managing editor, of CNN, author now of the new book, Cosby, His Life and Times. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. And Mark, before the break, you set us up to tell the story of how Bill Cosby punched Tommy Smothers in the head.
Yeah, well, you know, it was at a time in Cosby's life where he was a little adrift. After his great success, early success with his comedy albums and I Spy, in the 70s, his manager had put him into a production company and that went south and left him $50,000 short of being bankrupt. His comedy albums were no longer selling. He had had several TV shows that hadn't worked. He was earning his money mostly as a pitchman, starting to do those Jell-O commercials and Coke commercials. And in the fall of 1976, he was out on the West Coast starring in yet another show for ABC, a variety show that was the first. You can tell the first night the ratings were so terrible that it wasn't going to last. And it so happened that Muhammad Ali was fighting Ken Frazier at Madison Square Garden, and Hugh Hefner had installed closed circuit TV and invited a bunch of celebrities to the Playboy Mansion to watch the fight. And Cosby was friendly with Ali and so forth, but couldn't go to the fight because he was shooting the show. And before the fight began, Tommy Smothers came up, and they had a fraught relationship because Smothers, back in the 60s, had criticized Cosby for not addressing civil rights in the Vietnam War in his comedy. So Cosby didn't like him much to begin with. And Tommy Smothers came up to him and said, I saw your show. I like it. It's a good effort. And Cosby took that as just a lot of condescension from somebody who was the star of one of the iconic variety shows of all time. He thought Tommy Smothers was mocking him. Anyway, so Smothers, he sort of glared at him, and Smothers sort of stood there and glared back. And then he stormed off. Smothers stormed off. And Cosby followed him and hit him in the back of the head, knocked him to the ground. And it was, reported in the celebrity press out there and Variety and so forth. And I write about it in the book, not just to demonstrate that Cosby sometimes had a temper, but actually I think that was a bit of a turning point. He was about to turn 40. He had been living this life where his family was in Massachusetts, where they had moved in the early 70s when he started studying in the School of Education there, and because his wife really didn't like L.A. and Beverly Hills. And he had five children, so he was sort of, living. When he went home, he was a family man, but then he was spending a lot of time in L.A. Shooting these shows, and in Las Vegas performing, where he was leading a very different life, much more the life of a playboy. I think that after that episode, which mortified his wife, Camille, and then the show was canceled a few weeks later, and he sort of came home to Massachusetts with his tail between his legs. And the next year, all of a sudden, he cuts his hair. He gets a doctorate in education from the University of Massachusetts. And he sort of grows up, it's sort of in the public eye. And all of a sudden, rather than talking in his comedy about childhood as he did in the 60s, or sort of some of the, in the 70s, he was talking about gambling and other things, sort of trying to get a sense of sort of the licentious zeitgeist of the day. But all of a sudden, his material starts to be about turning 40 and being middle-aged and raising children and, the joys and frustrations of being a parent to five children. And it is that material as it develops, starting that year that he turns 40, that ultimately leads to The Cosby Show.
And what's interesting about The Cosby Show is that it did sort of bring together a lot of the themes that I guess he'd been thinking about. And in this early clip, I believe from the pilot in 1984, we can hear Cosby exploring some of the same ideas that got him in trouble when he gave the Brown v. Board speech. And this is a scene where Cosby as Cliff Huxtable is talking to Malcolm Jamal Warner as Theo Huxtable. And Theo wants to be a regular person, as he says, and not go to college and have a job that will pay him a lot of money. Let's just listen to some of that interaction.
I'm going to give you $300 a week.
Yes, indeed.
$300 a week, $1,200 a month. All right?
Great. I'll take it.
Yes, you will. And I will take $350 for taxes.
Whoa.
Huh? Yeah. Now, because, see, the government comes for the regular people first. Now, how much does that leave you with?
$850.
All right. Now, you've got to have an apartment because you are not going to live here. So, an apartment in Manhattan will run you at least $400 a month.
I'll live in New Jersey.
All right. You live in New Jersey, you've got to have a car.
I ride a motorbike.
You need a helmet. Figure $100 a month for clothes and shoes.
Figure $200. I want to look good.
Okay, so what does that leave you with?
$200. So no problem.
There is a problem. You haven't eaten yet.
Bill Cosby and Malcolm Jamal Warner from the pilot of The Cosby Show in 1984. Mark, so much there to love, to enjoy about that performance, which feels, you know, you mentioned jazz improvisation, feels very improvisational, even though I know it was scripted.
Well, there are a couple of very interesting things to say about that scene. First of all, it was based almost word for word, or at least the content of it, on a conversation, a very tense conversation that Cosby had with his son, Ennis, who was in some ways the apple of his eye, his only son, but who struggled in school and had some of the same problems that Theo did at that age. And one night, Cosby came back to his home in Massachusetts. He had been on the road. And Camille said to him, Ennis says he's not going to college, and you go talk to him. And Cosby went up to his room, and it went on all night long. He never got out of the clothes that he was wearing, and then he left at 5 in the morning to go back out on the road. The only thing that was actually added, and then he actually talked about that in his comedy routine, but the only thing that was added by the writers, Ed Weinberger and Michael Leeson, was using the Monopoly money, which was a great sort of visual addition to the routine. The other interesting thing to say about it was that that was a scene in the pilot, but it was originally shot for what was a presentation for advertisers, because the show was put together so quickly in the spring and summer of 1984 that they didn't even have time to shoot a full pilot. It was filmed out in L.A. They had just cast all the children and the family members, and they had only had one day of rehearsal before they shot that scene. And actually, Malcolm Jamal Warner had been cast on the last day of casting. And they filmed it before in front. They had two tapings of this presentation, one in the afternoon and one in the evening. And in the afternoon, when Theo gives this big speech about, I just want to be regular people and what's wrong with that and so forth, there was wild applause for him. And when Cosby came back with, that's the dumbest thing I've heard in my life, and you're going to study because I say so, and so forth and so on, there was applause, but not as much as Cosby thought. Cosby thought that the audience would side with him, the parent. But then in the evening, there were many more adults in the audience. And this time, although they laughed and applauded at Theo's speech, when Cosby turned the tables and said, "That's the dumbest thing, and you know, I brought you in this world, I can take you out," they not only applauded, they were hooting and hollering and on their feet, giving him standing ovation. And the producers who had put together the show and the director, Marcy Carsey and Tom Werner and Jay Sandridge, the director, Carsey and Werner, in approaching Cosby about doing a new family sitcom, had their idea, which was based on the material that was in his stand-up comedy, was that what was missing from the airwaves at the time, when sitcoms were considered dead to begin with, were any comedies where essentially you saw what they called the loving war between children and parents, but where the parents were still determined to stay in charge and to maintain their authority. So they thought that when they heard the applause for Cliff Huxtable laying down the law to Theo, that idea had been vindicated. Meanwhile, Jay Sandrich saw something even more profound, which was that the audience in the afternoon, the younger audience had identified with Theo. The older audience had identified with Cliff. And he thought to himself, if we can do a show where we can honestly show the perspective both of parents and of children so that parents see, you know, identify with the parents, and then children watching identify with the kids, we're really going to have something here.
The Cosby Show is so, when we think back to it, it took place almost entirely within their awesome brownstone. I guess they lived in Brooklyn or somewhere. It's hard to imagine what the show would have been if they had lived in much humbler digs.
That's true. And the interesting story about that was when Carsey and Werner approached Cosby through his agents, they got a meeting with him. And he invited them to dinner at his home in L.A., which is in the Pacific Palisades. And he had been toying, partly just because he was frustrated. Nothing else was really working except for his TV commercials at the time. He had just had a run of on Broadway with Sammy Davis Jr. that had bombed. So he had called his agent, Norman Brokaw, and said, you know, maybe it's time to think of a new TV show. So he was open to the idea of a TV show. But originally, he thought maybe he should do a drama, partly because he wanted to be paid a lot of money, and you got paid more in those days for doing a drama. But Marcy and Carsey and Tom Werner, whose background was in comedy, basically held their ground and said, no, you know, if you want to do that, that's fine, but we're not the people. We think you need to be in a family comedy, and we think it needs to reflect the point of view in your stand-up routine. And so Cosby warmed to that idea. But then his initial idea for the sitcom was that he would be a limo driver and that his wife would be Hispanic and be a plumber or a carpenter, partly because he thought it would be funny to have a marriage where the wife was handier than the husband and also where she would speak Spanish and he wouldn't understand what she was saying. And Carsey and Werner are sitting there thinking, you know, we really need Bill Cosby. They had gone out on their own from ABC, formed their own company. The first show that they tried with Madeline Kahn had been canceled. They had mortgaged their house, you know, taken out second mortgages on their house. This was sort of the last roll of the dice for them. And so they're thinking, you know, we need Bill Cosby. Don't argue with him. But then Marcy Carsey was also thinking, you know, this is Bill Cosby. We have to tell him what we really think. So they were very firm and held their ground and said, no, we think it will be more funny, more effective if, as is you see in your own routines, the parents are highly educated professionals and they're still having the same frustrations with their children that, you know, parents across America and across the world do. They went back and forth for hours about this. And finally, they got up from the table shortly before 1 o'clock in the morning. And as Marcy Carsey told me when I interviewed her, she said, I finally heard the words that made me think I was getting someplace with him. Cosby said, I think my wife would agree with you. And sure enough, the next day he called his wife, Camille, who was in Massachusetts, and briefed her on the meeting. And she was adamant. She said, you're not going to be a limo driver. You know, people associate you with, you know, Temple University and grad school and the characters you played before, a Rhodes Scholar spy and an I spy. And I'm not going to be a handy woman. And by which she meant, I don't think she was at all looking down on carpenters and plumbers, but I think she understood that he had already made the world, you know, think that when he was talking about family, he was talking about his own family. So that's what viewers would assume. And so once Camille put her foot down, he said, well, okay, I'll go with the producer's idea. And, you know, it sort of became liberating for him because once he bought into that concept, essentially he was bringing all kinds of things from their life into that comedy. They ended up having, the Huxtables had five children, just like them, four girls and a boy. They lived in, you know, a very elegant home with antiques, which, you know, Cosby's love antiques. They were lovers of jazz, and Cosby's a huge jazz fan and art. And in fact, in their private life, Bill and Camille Cosby not only are art collectors, they now have what is probably the most historically important and valuable private collection of African-American art in the world, which is finally going to be lent out to the Smithsonian so the public can see it in November. There was so much after that that came from his own life. And up to and including, you know, we started talking about that scene with Theo. Ennis, who had struggled in school and it was a great source of frustration to him but also to his father, when he finally went to college at Morehouse in Atlanta, was diagnosed as being a dyslexic. And Cosby, it sort of turned his academic career around, and Cosby decided to introduce that storyline. And in the last two seasons are largely about Theo discovering that he's dyslexic and how that changes his life.
Mark Whitaker is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Cosby, His Life and Times. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
Coming at you with music and fun. And if you're not careful, you may learn something before it's done.
That, of course, is the open to Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. We're speaking this hour with Mark Whitaker about his new biography of Cosby, Cosby, His Life and Times. Mark Whitaker is former managing editor of CNN. Mark, I hear that, and I just want to sit in front of my TV with a bowl of Jell-O pudding watching Fat Albert. But talk about how the concept for that show came about and what Cosby intended it to do for the kids who watched.
Well, Fat Albert first appears on one of Cosby's comedy albums in the 60s in a routine called Buck Buck Horse, where the local kids from the projects win the Buck Buck Championship, which is this game where, you know, kids jump on each other's backs because their secret weapon is Fat Albert. And he introduces the hey, hey, hey signature, and it sort of takes off. I mean, that album actually rose to be the number two album in America. And people just loved the idea of Fat Albert and the hey, hey, hey. But there really wasn't much more to the character than that. But Cosby, about 5 years later, Cosby was approached by Filmation, which did the Archie Saturday morning cartoon show, with the idea of turning Fat Albert into a Saturday morning cartoon show. And Cosby liked the idea, partly because, you know, he had already become one of the sort of early pioneers of educational children's television. He was one of the original guests on celebrity guests on Sesame Street, and he was one of the original cast members of The Electric Company, which was a show that ran for a while that sort of introducing kids who were a little bit older to reading. So he had become, and he had enrolled in the University of Massachusetts to get an advanced degree in education. So he was very interested in themes of education. And so he decided that he would use the show as an educational vehicle. And so, you know, you see, as is reflected, you know, in that signature about You Might Learn Something, that everybody remembers the sort of their adventures in the junkyard gang growing up in a housing project, much like the one Cosby grew up in Philadelphia, a much more idealized one on the cartoon. But each show had sort of a little bit of a lesson and a moral. And the Fat Albert character, rather than being the object of ridicule because of his weight, actually was the wise man, the peacekeeper, the one who kind of brought everybody together and helped them, you know, solve their problems together. And, you know, I interviewed Dwight Allen, who was the dean of the school, University of Massachusetts at Amherst School of Education, where Cosby was studying at the time, and had encouraged Cosby to take this approach with a cartoon show and then actually eventually to write a doctoral thesis about it. And he said that in his mind and Cosby's mind, Fat Albert's weight was sort of a metaphor for race. That the idea that someone who people at first blush might have prejudice or bigotry about sort of turns it around and ends up being, you know, showing that he can be wise and dignified and so forth. So that in a way, as Dwight Allen put it, Fat Albert was really Black Albert, and that was sort of very subliminally a point that Cosby was trying to make.
Is or was Bill Cosby the kind of father and husband that we all wished we had based on what we watched on The Cosby Show?
No, he wasn't. You know, which is not to say that he was a bad father, but, you know, Cliff Huxtable was a doctor who, you know, had his office in
the basement
in the basement of the brownstone and was around all the time. Cosby was a very successful entertainer who was gone from home a lot. I mean, he was on the road performing. He was, you know, in L.A. and other places. So he wasn't home anywhere near as much as Cliff. And he so Camille, his wife, really raised the children. And when he was around, I mean, he could be very loving and attentive, but he could also be very strict. And there's another episode with Ennis where they had gotten a call from school that Ennis wasn't turning in his homework, and Cosby confronted him, and Ennis made up a sort of lame excuse about somebody stole it from him or something, and Cosby didn't believe it, and he took him out to the barn behind the house and gave him what, you know, charitably was a spanking. I mean, you know, he describes as being very physical. So, you know, he had those moments. And there was also, you know, they had their second daughter, Erin, by the time she was in high school, had started to be a big partier and was using drugs and drinking. She eventually went to Spelman, but then decided after a year of barely going to classes that she was going to drop out. She had developed, you know, a $200 a day cocaine habit, and the her parents cut her off. You know, I think they continued to maybe send some money, but basically they kicked her out of the house. They said, "You're not welcome here." And she was estranged from the family for a decade. It was only really when her brother Ennis was murdered that they reconciled. So there was a lot of tough love there. It was hardly the warm and fuzzy Huxtables. Although, you know, there was also a lot of the things that are reflected in that show, the respect for education, for art, and so forth, was very much part of their family life.
I think it seemed to a lot of Americans when Ennis Cosby was murdered that they felt it very deeply because they felt like Theo Huxtable was murdered, which is sort of a strange way to describe something, but it caused a lot of people to have a profound response to this sad event.
Right. And in fact, you know, the Theo's character, as much more probably than any other character on that show, had been based almost sort of, you know, at every point in his development on Ennis. And Malcolm Jamal Warner and Ennis Cosby had become friends. So even though most of America had, you know, Cosby and his wife in particular kept their family very, very private during those years when he was the biggest celebrity in America. They had never seen Ennis Cosby for the most part. They didn't know who he was, but they felt, as you say, that they knew him. He, after being diagnosed as dyslexic, he had ended up graduating on the dean's list from Morehouse and enrolled at Columbia with the intention of devoting his life to helping kids with learning disabilities, starting with getting a doctorate. On winter break, he had gone out to Los Angeles to visit an old high school friend, and he was driving a car, a very expensive Mercedes convertible that the Cosbys kept out there for their personal use when they were in L.A. And he gets a flat tire on the San Diego freeway in the middle of the night and pulls over to change the tire. And he was murdered by a guy who it took several months for them to catch him, but turned out to be a 19-year-old Ukrainian immigrant, essentially a delinquent who had a lot of problems already with the criminal justice system. And he ended up being convicted and sent to jail for life and actually would have been eligible for the death penalty, except the Cosbys, who don't believe in the death penalty, ask that, you know, that be taken off the table. I think people did feel, you know, partly because Cosby was such a big celebrity, but also, as you say, because they felt they knew him. More people tuned in at the time. NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw was the leading newscast. More people watched that broadcast that night. I think the numbers were only equaled or surpassed when Brokaw stepped down 5 or 6 years later. So, it changed Cosby's life. I think actually some of the sort of passion that he brings to talking about education and parenting now, I think, is partly the result of trying to give some meaning to Ennis's death. He also, as I discovered in studying him and interviewing him, always was an incredible workaholic. I mean, once he pulled himself together and found his vocation in comedy, he always worked very hard. But he took solace in work and just going back on the road performing, which he does to this day. And I think that's partly how he copes with Ennis's death. But he also, you know, some parents, and I think, you know, everybody can agree that it's probably one of the worst things that can happen to you in life is to lose a child. But some people who go through that just can't be bear to be reminded on a regular basis of the child they've lost. With Cosby, it's the opposite. He carries reminders of Ennis wherever he goes. First of all, he buried Ennis on his property in Massachusetts, so he sees the gravesite whenever he goes home. I think everybody who's kind of seen him recently will recognize that he's frequently wearing sweatshirts that say, "Hello, friend." And if you go to his concerts, if he's not wearing one of those sweatshirts, he has one draped over the back of his chair where he sits while he's performing. And "Hello, friend" was Ennis's signature greeting. It's how he greeted everybody in his life. And also, you know, I talked earlier about the Cosbys art collection. The Cosbys have commissioned dozens of portraits and busts of Ennis, likenesses, that they have throughout their four homes. And Cosby often talks to his son or talks to those likenesses about what's going on in the family and what's going on with Ennis's friends from college. And I think it's also, to me, the thing that, you know, made it so moving. And in the book, I try to introduce you. You see Ennis growing up, and then you see what happens to him and the effect it has on his father. But it's also, you know, it turns what is already a really remarkable life into something that's almost Shakespearean. When you think about how far Cosby had come, all the success he had had, the heights to which he had climbed, and then to suffer this terrible tragedy, later in his life. And, you know, it's just a reminder that, you know, nobody, there's good and bad in everybody's life. And Cosby is just a very extreme example of both.
Was he a hard guy, Mark, to get to know?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. This is people have asked me whether this is an authorized biography. At first, it was not at all. It was not his idea. It was my idea. When I first approached him through Alvin Poussin, his advisor from Harvard, who's someone I knew, he was not interested in helping me. He even had his lawyer call me to say he wasn't going to help me. But I think when he saw, I went ahead anyway, and I think when he saw that I was not giving it up and that I was persistent and that I was starting to talk to people, and maybe he heard back from them that I, you know, was not, I was wanted, this was a serious book. It wasn't sort of a kiss-and-tell kind of book. Eventually, I started hearing from his publicist that there were things he wanted me to read, and then eventually he called me. And it was really interesting. You know, I mean, I've been a journalist for 40 years, and he was unlike anybody I had ever interviewed. I mean, first of all, I could never schedule an interview. he would just call me out of the blue, often late at night. Usually with something very specific that he wanted me to know about. But I learned very quickly that there's no such thing as a short phone conversation with Bill Cosby. So once he was on the phone, he started telling stories. And my job, I decided, was to be ready with the questions that would elicit the stories that I needed for the book. The other thing is, he doesn't think, you know, people in our business are used to being around people who, you know, are very good at thinking and expressing themselves in a very linear way. He's the opposite. He tells stories. He's not linear. He's associative. He's creative. He's intuitive. But he's also incredibly vivid. So I really had to make sure. Sometimes I didn't quite know what he was talking about. He would veer off on a tangent. But I had to make sure that I got it all down. And when I went back to write from it, I discovered that there was all this incredibly vivid detail, sights, sounds, smells, memories, in what he had told me, which is, I think, one of the reason his stand-up and his comedy to this day remain so rich.
Mark Whitaker's new biography is called Cosby, His Life and Times. Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.